Welcome to Game Brain, a board game podcast about our gaming group. I am Matthew Robinson, and this week I am joined by my absolute favorite co-host on this podcast, one of the sweetest, funniest, kindest, most... Okay, well, this is awkward. I realized I was just reading last week's notes. I'm sorry. This week I'm joined by Paul.
Hey, everyone.
Paul Satochit, the game breaker, yeah.
Okay. The sweetest, kindest, nothing that everyone's ever known.
I'm trying to stay on theme here because today we're going to be telling you our top 10 meanest games. And so I wanted to start with my top five meanest things I could do to Paul.
That's right. Like, you know, Matt wanted to announce his presence with authority.
This is round 10, turn 6. Today we're going to be reviewing the 2020 release Dune Imperium. And yes, as I said, we are going to be going over our top 10 meanest games. Paul, what does that mean? What is a meanest game?
I was thinking about the Supreme Court, and they say, like, you know, I know obscenity when I see it. And so I know mean when I see it. But, like, ultimately, I think for our definitions, like, games that, like, promote what's the best way to say it?
Like a take that element?
Sure. But, like, I would say that it would be, like, some games, like, you know, you can hate draft or something where you take a suboptimal move and you could hurt someone more. But mean games tend to be, like, you know, oh, the meanest move I could make, the one that hurts him the most, is also the move that is the best for me.
Right. Yeah. So I mean, because, you know, every war game in essence is mean, right? Because you're aggressing each other. But this is more about sort of Euro style games that have a mean element to them.
Absolutely. Like, you know, where in war games you have no choice but to be at each other. Like in a mean game, there is actually the option to you know, be nicer, but right, rewarded for not.
Right. So these would sort of be the top 10 games that Rado would not play. Top 10 meanest games. I'm excited to get into that when we get there. And our Dune Imperium review. Paul and there's a lot of big Dune fans on our podcast, but Paul and I are definitely big Dune fans, lifelong Dune fans. So it'll be interesting to get into that. Paul, how you been?
I've been okay. Like, my parents got the first vaccine shot, like, you know.
Hallelujah. Yep. Mine too. Congrats.
Yeah. And it's, Trey had a reaction where when he found out that his parents were getting it, he was tearing. And I found myself a similar, you know, kind of relief of that, where, like, oh, okay. So what's hard is, like, you know, it's so close, right? We're so close to just being done with it. And if you were to, like, fall at 5 feet from the finish line, it's just so much more tragic.
It is. Yeah, I know. I mean, I took my mother to Dodger Stadium to get her shot. And the entire time I'm thinking, like, if I get COVID and give it to my mom in this car ride, that's going to be really, really not funny.
Yeah, no, it's strange. Like, you know, because I think I was just keeping it in. Like, you know, just kind of like suppressing it.
Yeah.
Like, because, you know, like, you go into that, like, disaster mode, and you just compartmentalize, or I compartmentalize, and I go, yeah, I'm fine. And then all of a sudden, like, oh.
We were all playing a game throughout the last year called Don't Kill Your Parents.
That is truthfully it. Like, there was always this idea of, like, oh, you know, is this visit worth their death? and they're, you know, like, it turns out the answer is never yes. It's never yes.
Never yes. And yet, we all had moments where we're like, did I just kill my mom? I hope I didn't kill my mom there.
That, yeah, it's not a good feeling. It's not a good feeling at all. So yeah, so
we're within a month of beating the Don't Kill Your Parents game.
Yes.
To get that second,
like, you know,
shot.
But then it comes, like, you know, hey, will you survive?
Yeah. Well, our odds are better to begin with. I mean, mine, not yours. You are in trouble if you get it. But I'm good. I'm good,
I think. Well, I read somewhere that if you were type O blood, you have a little bit more resistance than A and B. And I'm a B+. you know, not just in blood type, but in life.
Yeah, and, just as a person. Yeah. That's about, so, that's, I mean, it's a little high, but, you know.
I'm just, B+. They don't go down to C. So, like, you know. But yeah, so if you happen to be an O blood type, maybe you have a little bit like it's like a what you call it? Like a D&D racial bonus.
You're like an elf. You got a little edge.
That's right.
Well, good. Yes, I'm glad, and I hope everybody listening is doing what they can if you're in America to get your 65 and over parents inoculated and good to go. And then all of us will follow eventually. So say we all. Let's get into this week's game night. Game night. What you played this week, Paul?
Well, you know, Dune Imperium, of course, and we'll talk about that. I played a lot of Carnegie, which I just learned was pronounced Carnegie as opposed to Carnegie. Yeah,
I'm just going to say Carnegie because
you're an American. That's what my thought process too. I was going like, you know, I was taught this. I'm allowed to say this, but they go like, you know, there's actually a right way and a wrong way. And apparently Carnegie is the right way. So I guess
what do you think about Carnegie? Would you give it a car negative review? Thank you, everybody. It was great hosting this podcast, and we'll see you all later. Bye-bye.
Try the veal. I really enjoyed it. But I felt like I grokked it quicker than the people I was playing with, just maybe about a half turn or a turn quicker. But like giving me the ability to do a half turn quicker means like, you know, like I'm positioning myself to punish people. And so like, you know, there was this point where I was playing and I just looked at Alfred's board and I was going like, oh, I see it now. Don't move till you see it. And I saw it. I go like, I see what this game is. Mm-hmm. And so like I'm still kind of riding the high of that. Like, you know, it is a long game.
It is. It's very long. Yeah. You guys played an absurdly long game. I heard it was like 7 hours. I mean, that's absolutely insane. And
to be fair, with a teach. So like, you know, so we only played like a 6.5 hour game.
that's silly. This is brass length. This is 3 to 4 hours. Yeah. This should not be 7 hours. You're doing something wrong. If you're sorry, but that's absurd. This is a full game night game. This is not even an 18XX half day game. This is just you're not playing a filler. You're just playing this, but it's a game night.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really enjoyed it. Like once again, I had maybe a game and a half of it. I played a game and a half, and I don't know how much longevity it has with its like length. And there's, you know, like when you start playing a new game for the first time, and you have that like, you know, the honeymoon of the new. I don't know if it has the legs that I would want for like a lifestyle game where you just go, oh, let's play this.
Yeah. Well, I think a lifestyle game needs to have a absurd level of variation. And I'm not sure this has in terms of board setup. I really enjoyed it. I've played it twice now. I've actually played it a couple times solo because if you didn't know, it's on Board Game Arena. Very easy to play, does all the automation for you, the publisher approved, and it's the solo mode is on there, and it's totally worth giving a shot. The solo mode is actually pretty simple. If you read the rules, you'll have it explained to you. Even if you don't know what you're doing, it will do all the automation for you. But it's really solid. It's Xavier George, who's the designer who also did Trois, my favorite game of all time. Although I think that estimation might be changing this year, but it's still one of my beloved games, and it doesn't feel anything like Trois. It also Ben Mendelker says it feels to him like Black Angel. I don't know if I remember Black Angel enough to say that I agree with that. When I think of Black Angel, I can't think of much that is reminding me of it. But it. Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't necessarily feel like a Xavier George game, where in the way that Trois and Black Angel felt very similar to me. This feels like and I don't say bog standard as a negative. This feels like a bog standard engine builder. It's like you're buying buildings or rooms, as they are, that are going to give you a specific route. You've got four different income levers that you're going to be potentially expanding at different levels. And then you've got a map that you're trying to build a line on, a connection that's going to score victory points at the end. So nothing in it is like something I've never seen before, but it does come together in a satisfying way. And the worker manipulation and management is really interesting. And I think probably the best part of it for me.
Yeah, no, the way that it reminds me of Toi and those things is like Toi is a certain elegance or simplicity about its what it's trying to do. And I feel like once you see it, like, you know, what Carnegie is trying to do, I think it achieves it fairly well. Whether it's worth the squeeze is a different question.
Yeah, there's 16 buildings in the game right now. I mean, the buildings are what's going to change in every game. A certain amount of them are taken out, except in a four-player game where it's always the same build, two of each, right? On the Kickstarter that's still live, they say they're designing more buildings. And so I think that could be the difference between it being a lifestyle game or not, or a game like Barrage that we play on the regs. But it also doesn't have any asymmetry, which is, I think, what gives Barrage a lot of its legs. It's like, oh, I want to try this corporation this time and, you know, see sure, how sure. I do. I think a lot of our favorite games either have like an endless supply of variation, like Agricola, or a constant wanting to try different factions like Gaia Project or Barrage.
Sure. I mean, it's, you know, and I know that like it's too soon for an expansion, but like that can easily be changed by like, yeah. I don't know. And it looks like, you know, it's ripe for that. Like, you know, I feel like this is like the base game and modules will be designed for this.
Yeah, I can see that.
So I'm not worried about that. Like, I think people should check it out on BGA. I think like it's, well, the automation is great. The only negative is if you're playing with several people, like, you know, there are a bunch of micro turns. So if you play async, that is monstrously slow.
Yeah, it can be. It's wildly interesting, and definitely I would be very surprised if it's not on some of our top 10 lists for 2021.
Yep.
I think it's a pretty interesting game.
One other game that I finished this week was Game of Maria between...
Yeah, you and Ben, and who else?
His name is Nick Mallory, a friend of the of Ben's, and it was very interesting. I had never finished Maria before, and Ben won in a... I wouldn't say spectacular, but like what's like spectacular minus one, you know, it was pretty amazing, like what he chose to do, because, you know, Maria basically, much like Friedrich, is a war game that has logistics. Well, anyway, Ben did a move in the first year that everyone, i.e. Nick and I, were going like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? This is, you know, like, you know, do you not know how to play this game? And Ben, you know, was on the ropes as far as defending it, whether he had like a nefarious super strategy or he made a mistake. It doesn't matter, because in the end, he crushed because of it. And ultimately, it was either the luckiest move ever or like a masterclass in the manipulation of Nick Mallory. And either way, it's probably somewhere in between, but like it was so good to see like Ben just like come in and destroy. And I was like, wow, that was great. That was a great game.
I've never played Maria before. Do you think it's a game I would like? You know what I like.
I think it's a game that you would be interested in and learning the mechanics. I don't think you would love it for more than two or three games. And more than anything, I think you really have to enjoy the company of the people you're playing with. I couldn't imagine wanting to play this as a tournament game, because the game itself is so like, eventually, like, and this is me projecting, having finished only one game, the game itself, I think, lends itself to each faction has a certain style that is going to be dominant, and it's be so dominant that like it winds up being a grind once everyone
gets it. And it's a full day game, right? I mean, this is a long game.
Like what we did was there are 4 years, which consists of three turns each. And we played 1 year a week in one night. So we played like year one.
And how long would a year take on average?
A year would take us. We start at 8:30 and end up to around midnight.
Okay, yeah. So this is a full day of game. This is a 12-hour game.
It can be. It definitely can be. Like, you know, maybe we were a little slower and we finished after 2.3 years. Mm. So like so it doesn't have to go the full distance.
Yeah, yeah.
But in the end, it was great. You know, it was great to play. You know, it was on Ben's like, I'm ashamed as a game player. I haven't finished this because it's on my blah, 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 blah list. And I very much enjoy the concept of Friedrich and playing Maria. I enjoy that too. Once again, like I'm not a big kind of war game fan because eventually, like, you know, it comes down to, like, you know, how much you understand the board, study. It comes down to study, basically. And I don't know if I'm not a person who likes to study board games. I'm more of an intuitive player.
Right. Yeah, it might not be worth the squeeze.
What about you? What did you play?
Yeah, I played some Carnegie. I played some Doom Imperium, and I think the favorite game I played this week was we had a rousing game of Terraforming Mars Prelude on the app with Trey, Ben, and Tom, and I, and we had a very fun time playing that game. I really love Terraforming Mars with Prelude. I think it is. I think it could be a lifestyle game, one of those games that you just play regularly. There is a small element of take that, you know, which is potentially annoying. But outside of that, yeah, it feels a lot. I understand why a lot of Agricola players have jumped over to Terraforming Mars, as there's just so much to explore there. We had a really good game. I know you do not like Terraforming Mars, but
it's really funny because, like, you know, I've come to realize that I'm probably not a farm game person. And in a way, Terraforming Mars is just a farm game. Mm-hmm. In that, you know, you're literally tilling the land, making it.
Yeah, it doesn't matter where the farm is; it's not your jam.
That's right. Whether it be like in Germany or like, you know, what's the mountain, like, you know, like Mars, like, you know, Olympus Mountains. That's the mountain on Mars.
So the Terraforming Mars app is fantastic, and it still has some minor glitches every once in a while or things that go a little odd, but it's very playable. All right, let's get into the news.
Good evening, Mr. Mission Office, South America, and all the ships and clippers at sea. Let's go to France.
In 18XX news this week, 1860 Railways on the Isle of Wight. A game from Mike Hutton is finally on Kickstarter. This is a beloved 18XX and notable because it is considered the best two-player 18XX. And by best, I mean maybe one of the only ones. There's not a lot of great two-player 18XXs, but this is the one. So if you have a dedicated gaming partner and you are interested in 18XX or you love 18XX, I think it is well worth checking out 1860 Railways on the Isle of Wight. I've never played it, but I've always been curious what a two-player 18XX that is sort of designed for two would feel like. It does play to, I think, four or five even. One side of the board is for two or three players, another side is for more. But yeah, I think definitely worth interest, definitely worth checking out if that sounds interesting to you.
Like another all, piece of yeah, all 18XX have, like, you know, the stock market component, right?
Yeah, I've never seen one that doesn't. Yeah,
and so, like, I'm just curious how, you know, that will play out in a two player 18XX,
because it could be a little zero sum.
Exactly. So that's very interesting to me. So I'm curious how they implement that.
Yeah, 2, 4, 6. It looks like there's 8 different companies in the game, so that could definitely. It seems like in a two player game, you'd probably be owning 3 or 4 of those, I would imagine. In other 18XX news, this one's very interesting to me. 1880 China, which is considered by many one of the great 18XXs, but this one is notable because it is been impossible to get forever. Out of print, impossible to buy, wildly expensive, on the aftermarket. And now Lookout Spiel, which is one of my favorite publishers that do a lot of great games, notably last week's review of review game Hallertau. So a big Euro game designer is putting out 1880 China, which is very exciting. No actual announcement of when that's happening, but they released a new box cover for it, and it is definitely in the works. So that is very exciting on the 18XX front. Let's see, what else? We've got the first expansion for Paladins of the West Kingdom, City of Crowns, coming to Kickstarter in the next week or two from Garfield Games. I really like Paladins of the West Kingdom. I actually love it, I think. It might be my favorite of all of that series of games. But I don't know if I need to play it as anything other than a solo game, because it is a solo game. But it's fantastic solo game.
Like in our group, I think it's a little divisive. I think some people feel like it's not enough of a game, and some people feel like it's a perfect game for what it delivers. For those people, like, I wonder if the expansion, when an expansion comes out, I almost always am enthusiastic about it. It doesn't matter if I feel like the game needs it or not. Like, what I always want to see is how much someone things to, like, you know, augment their product and see if it's worth the money that they are charging.
Yeah, and I'll be curious to see if this is the answer to the complaint of some of that it's multiplayer solitaire, or if it's a doubling down on the multiplayer solitaire and just going like, yeah, that's what it is.
And that's a must buy for Matt then. Boom.
either way, it's a must buy. But yeah, I'm interested to see what happens with City of Crowns coming to Kickstarter in the next week or two. And if you go to Garfield Games, you can find a link to be notified of when that will come on Kickstarter for you. We have the birth of a new game company called Rose Gauntlet Entertainment. This is a new game company by Isaac Vega, the designer of Dead of Winter, and a creative director and designer named Lindsay Rode. They have joined forces to begin their own game company. I always think it's great when designers come together to start their own sort of record label, if you will.
Sure.
They have announced a handful of games that we have not much information on other than the titles of them, but you can go to their website, which is rosegauntlet.com, and learn lots more about this exciting new venture, and we wish them the best. Always great to see new players enter the sphere. Let's see, a new game from Spielworks coming out. Spielworks, which is known for all the games that we like pretty much in the last couple of years. They have done PAX Pamir and La Granja and Die Macher and Arkwright and Gentes and Diluvia Project, and most recently The Cost. These games then often get picked up by Spielworks and put out by other people eventually. But they, for me, are always must try. Whatever comes out from Spielworks is a game that I have to check out. This new one, coming to Kickstarter on February 19th, is a dice bag building game in a steampunk universe. Yes, I'm in for that. Whatever that means.
Take my money.
Yeah, just, yep, I'm good. I'm in for that. The designer is a new designer I hadn't heard of before, named Bernd Scholes. As always with Spielworks, they have limited print runs. Only 1,000 copies of this will be made, and then potentially it gets picked up by somebody else and printed more. But always worth looking into the new Spielworks game, because they always put out really heavy, fun, cool new stuff. This one is fun. Paul, you and I have a past with pinball, don't we?
We have a past with pinball. We were in a pinball league.
Paul and I, you probably didn't even know that exists, but there are amateur pinball leagues in probably every major city in the world. And we were in one in Los Angeles together, and we would go to a Korean barbecue place that had a pinball room in the back with 30 to 40 pins in it. Yes, they're called pins. And we'd be paired up in groups of four and we'd play competitive pinball. And Paul and I, we won the entire, no, we didn't. We were horrible. Yeah, that's right. And we were at the bottom of the leaderboard.
Well, you know, like in the rock opera Tommy, there's the pinball wizard, but they don't talk about
the pinball loser.
Exactly.
The pinball idiot.
That's right. That was me. Like, you know, Matt, you know, Matt slightly, I don't know, like better is absolutely the word, but like there is this aspect where when we're playing Dice Masters, do you remember how I was whatever the case, I just was a slightly luckier or better than you at every like 0.001%. So when we were we played tournament, like, you know,
Paul and I also played Dice Master tournaments, if you can believe that, about, I don't know, six, seven years ago.
Yeah, probably. Bonding experience. You know, this is like the bedrock of, not the only stone, but like, you know, definitely like, you know, bedrock of our friendship. Like, you know.
Yeah.
And
I love going to tournaments and game playing tournaments with you. I think we've done that. We went to a Netrunner tournament, the first ever Netrunner tournament ever held in Los Angeles. Paul and I went to together.
Yes, and got destroyed and commiserated. Destroyed.
We thought we were so good. We had this little two-person meta, and we were like, oh, we're the best. And we showed up and just got trounced.
Yeah. Oh, and then we did the Game of Thrones one too.
Yeah, we sure did.
And I did okay.
We did a lot of Game of Thrones tournaments.
Yeah, I did okay with that because I copied someone's deck and the deck auto played.
Yeah, there you go. We just net decked forever and just prayed. Well, I hope we get to go to some gaming tournaments together in the future. That's always one of my favorite things ever.
Absolutely. Anyway, pinball was the inverse of that, where I felt like Matt was always just like, oh man, you won again.
Yeah, I always just had like one better bonus than you, or one more skill shot. Well, the reason we're talking about pinball at all is because Super Skill Pinball, which is a roll and write game from Jeff Engelstein, is getting its first standalone sequel. This is called Super Skill Pinball Ramp It Up. Similar to the last one in that it had four pins, as we call them in the inner circles of pinball players. This has four new ones that's going to implement the new world of ramps. A lot of people don't know that ramps were actually the first major innovation in pinball. It didn't come around until like the 70s, I believe. But those plastic ramps that are so
ubiquitous,
basic today, ubiquitous on all pins, are were not a thing that existed in the old EM pins from the 40s, 50s, and 60s. So it makes sense that the first expansion would be all about ramps or standalone sort of second game. I would love to play Super Skill Pinball with you, Paul. I think it is a really, really solid roll and write. And I'm saying that as someone who really doesn't care about roll and write and doesn't necessarily enjoy them at all. But of all the ones I've tried, this has come the closest to something that I potentially enjoy. And not just because of the theme, but it genuinely does feel like you're playing pinball. So
cool. Like, you know, I'm always game.
Yeah, well, we'll give it a whirl when the corona is over. And lastly, this news just annoys me, but there is a new deck of Agricola cards coming out. Now, here's why this annoys me, because I have an insert for my copy of Agricola Revised, and I just got the D deck. They've had the A, B, C, and finally the D deck came, and it perfectly fit in my insert. And now, from A to D, it's full. I couldn't fit a single more card in, and I was like, you know what? I bet they're done, and that's awesome, and it all fits in the box. And now they're coming out with another deck. It's not even called the E deck. Now it's called the Console Dirigens deck, and it's more cards to go in the C and D deck. I don't even know what that means. They're expanding other expansions. But you know what? I'm going to ignore it because it annoys me, and it doesn't fit in my box.
You're going to ignore it for now.
For now. For now.
For today.
You know what? I would have to have a second box for this to go in to go. And that's just annoying. That's not going to fit on the shelf.
You'll upgrade your box and, you know, I don't want to tell your future, but like, you know, how is your journey to being the world champion Agricola of 2021 coming along?
So I started in my Agricola path to becoming the number one Agricola player in the world. I started at the bottom, and I am, let me check the leaderboards, at the very bottom still.
You ever see the Office episode where the cold open is like Jim gets some letterhead for Dwight and then faxes it to Dwight saying future Dwight?
Right.
So that's what I want to do to you. I'm going to go like future Matt, like, you know, you are the best Agricola player in the world. You're the Magnus Carlsen of Agricola. Like, just keep the faith. Like, you know.
Yes, I love it.
So that's what I want to do. But it'll be sent via email because no one has a fax anymore.
That's true. All right, let's move along to Games on the Oh, yeah. What's on that beautiful brain of yours, Paul?
So, like, you know, it wouldn't be an episode with Paul on it without me always mentioning how I listen to this now at 2.5 speed. But
7.9 speed.
But I will say that the thing that is most lost on at that speed is the second version of Games on the Brain, the remix. Like I listened to the remix of all this.
Oh, I better be crazy at 2.0.
It's you lose all the nuance. You lose all the nuance. Like whereas like some things like, you know, Game Sommelier, like you go, oh, we're getting through it quick.
Yeah.
but Games on the
Brain, my episodes.
That's right. But Games on the Brain, like, you know, you go like, oh, you're really missing. It's really, anyway. Games on my brain.
What's on your brain?
Carnegie. You know, I've a friend of mine has invited me to his game group on BGA, and so now I'm playing Terra Mystica, which I haven't played in a very, 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 very long time because
on BGA, I'm guessing
on BGA, yes, yeah. And because, like, you know, ultimately Tom, you know, poo-poos it, like Gaia Project or nothing.
Yeah, that's not quite. Yeah, I mean. If Gaia Project was on there,
sure.
Would you ever play Terra Mystica?
Well, it's very interesting because I don't know. I'm not even through the first move yet because they're playing Terra Mystica in a way that we have actually never did, which was
people take it very seriously. Lumen Sperling, who's, you know, the Agricola champ and a person who I watch stream Agricola, all the other game that Lumen streams is Terra Mystica and sure. Takes it crazy seriously.
Absolutely. And so now what they're doing is they're doing the bidding for factions. Everyone picks a faction. Everyone gets like 30 VP and then you just start bidding for them.
Right. So you self-balance the unbalanced factions.
Exactly. Which, you know, it's slick, you know, and it's probably been done for a while now. We just haven't like seen it. We've never played it.
That's always fun, especially if you happen to be really good with a faction that is not necessarily considered that great, you can get quite a steal on that.
Absolutely. And so what was I'm very slow playing it right now because like I'm playing with people who are from MIT. And so I feel like they are people who, you know, would have studied the game. And
where'd you find this group of smarty pants?
The smarty pants, a friend of mine, like he's been friends since UCLA days. So like in the 90s, like, you know, dear friend of mine. And so like the factions that they picked were so, so finesse factions. Like right. I went and go like, I'm pick dwarves. I'm not going to be the jerk who just picks darklings and like, you know, blah, blah, blah. But right. Like, you know, I pick dwarves. I go like, hopefully, you know, this should be enough to announce.
Wasn't halflings the worst? Isn't that kind of.
Halflings were down there. Like giants were also like, you know, the regarded as like the power with no power. Like, you know, its advantage is its disadvantage. And the fakirs were never like, you know,
and both
of them are in the mix. And I was going like, oh man, they hate drafting factions. Like, you know, and so I'm doing all this analysis of like going, oh, now I got slow bid everything and make sure like blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And so I ended up with a faction, the Alchemists, which I don't necessarily like, but like, you know, mm-hmm. You know, they're a fine balance in some hands, a very strong faction. But like I was doing all this like bid kind of manipulation on a meta that I didn't understand. And so all of a sudden I ended up with a faction that is that's not what I wanted necessarily. But like, you know, the bid just went like 26 to the range was 26 to 30. And so that's just a four point difference. And I go like, you know, the last time I played this, Giants did not lose just by 4 points. Like, I think.
Right.
And so like, it was this aspect where I go like, oh, I'm always just when you don't know the meta, you don't know what to expect, and you just project the worst. Right. You know, and it may never be that way. Like, you know, sometimes you just have to just jump in and just see how it is. And I was like, oh, I should have just jumped in as opposed to try to, you know, outthink it all.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, so just sort of learn the meta. That's fun. I would like to try that too. I miss Terra Mystica. I mean, I miss Gaia Project as well, but Terra Mystica is on BGA.
Exactly.
Very playable.
Absolutely. Very playable.
What's on my brain? A game called Curious Cargo, which I specifically would really like to play with you, and hopefully we can get that on Tabletop Simulator. It is from Ryan Corney, the designer of Pipeline, and it is the pipe laying aspect of Pipeline as a two-player only game.
Huh.
Okay. And it's, I am laying pipes on my end, you are laying pipes on yours, and they are connected, and I am trying to ship goods through my pipes onto cars, and then I push those cars into yours, and you have to ship them through your pipes to the other side, and there's like sort of a fun trying to build my pipes in a way that will push goods that are not good for your pipes so that you're stuck with things. And I think it looks quite heavy, actually. Like, the people are saying, like, this is not, you know, Pipeline for Dummies, or, you know, light version. This is not the patchwork Two Fields of Odin.
Sure,
this
sure.
is a heavy, puzzly, thinky two-player game that, yeah, I got a copy of because people seem to love it. But I would love to try it with you.
Oh, that sounds like right up my alley. Right.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. All right. Shall we get into our review for the week, Paul?
Wait. Don't we have like an 8x8 challenge?
No, we skip that now. We just skip that forever and ever and ever. Today's review is the 2020 release of Dune Imperium, designed by Paul Denon, who is most known for being the designer of Clank. The artists are Clay Brooks and Nate Storm, and the publisher is Direwolf, which is a publishing group also best known for Clank. It plays 1 to 4 players in 60 to 120 minutes, which, it's about 120 minutes. And BGG has it as a weight of 2.90. Dune Imperium is a deck building worker placement hybrid that is set in the Dune movie universe, the Dune unreleased movie by Denis Villeneuve, which was supposed to come out in fall of 2020 and has now been pushed to fall of 2021. And the game was supposed to come out simultaneously with the movie, but instead we just get the game because the movie got pushed a year because of COVID. And so this is a Dune game, but you will not recognize that Thufir Hawit is a woman, I believe, in this game. And yeah, you know, it's all based on the actors. Luckily, it's not just images from the movie. It's actually art, but based on the likenesses of actors in the movie. There are some characters that I'm not familiar with. There are some images that are not what I would expect to have seen for Dune. So it is a little bit of a spoiler for the movie in some aspects, especially the image of the Kwisatz Haderach, which looks like some sort of a DMT trip. And I'm very curious if that is actually what the Kwisatz Haderach is going to look like in the movie. It looks like Galactus or something. A giant walking through space.
Well, you know, it's probably like a dream sequence kind of thing. Thing. Like, they right. Even Lint of Doom had, like, you know, like, oh, I take the spice, yeah. Oh, I'm sleep traveling within, away. Blah blah blah.
But yeah, it is interesting to be playing a game based on a movie that doesn't exist yet, or at least for the public it doesn't exist. But yeah, Paul, tell us about Dune Imperium. Break it down for us.
Well, you know, it is your how should I put it? Like, you know, if I were to like be as reductive as possible with it, it is basically Dominion plus a board, you know, that and a little asymmetry. So basically, it's a 1 to 4 player game. Everyone has a faction. Each faction has a unique power, both in ongoing and both in when you play a certain card. And you basically draw 5 cards. You play. Oh, okay. Let me. You draw 5 cards. You have what are called agents. These agents are pieces that you put on the board. And when you put your pieces on the board, you take an action. You take an action. What that that
yeah, board. Pretty basic worker placement stuff.
Absolutely. And you have two of those, and once you're out of agents, you show the rest of your cards, and the rest of your cards will have a certain number of points depending on what card they are, and with those points, influence points, you buy another card.
Or as many cards as you want, yeah.
Exactly. And then once everyone has done that, there's a combat phase that is part of the board, and whoever wins that combat phase gets the first prize and second and third, and then you repeat until someone gets 10 points.
Right. So, and this is, that's an interesting endgame condition, because it can end in two ways. It can either, there's 10 conflict cards, and if you get to the last conflict card, whoever's the most points win. The tiebreaker, of course, is whoever has the most spice, if you know Dune, that makes sense. Otherwise, it's the first person to 10 automatically wins the game, which is sort of, has a feel, and Trey pointed this out, and I agree with him, it has a Settlers of Catan feel to it, in that everybody's scores are going to be pretty close in the end, and it's sort of going to come down to any hidden points that you have in cards and things like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is quite literally deck building plus worker placement. And whatever you're imagining when you think of deck building and worker placement, that's just those two things are together.
That's right.
It's very, very simple worker placement. Place a worker. You can only place a worker, you know, as Paul said, depending on if the card you've played has the location that worker can go to. And then, yeah, sometimes the cards will have a bonus as well. And then, yeah, at the end, after you've played your workers, or even if you don't want to play all your workers, you can just dump your whole hand in front of you and add up all the invisible money points you get, just like Dune, and then go shopping and buy cards, throw them in your discard. When your deck's empty, shuffle your discard into your deck. And that's how deck building works. Yeah, so, I mean, there are a couple of cool things that this game does. Now, we reviewed earlier in the year Lost Ruins of Arnak.
Yes.
Which also is quite literally deck building plus worker placement. This is very similar to that, which is funny because we've got sort of two versions of a very similar game with different themes, you know, Indiana Jones versus Dune, actually Dune versus, you know, not actually Indiana Jones. Their goals are very similar. Clank was an interesting deck building hybrid as well. It wasn't worker placement, but it was kind of you're moving your meeple into a dungeon and trying to get out as quickly as possible. And, you know, there's a push your luck element to it. So it makes sense that the designer would be playing with that. But yeah, things that it does interesting, of course, is asymmetrical powers. I'm always more excited by a game if it has asymmetrical powers. And as any Dune game would, you can play as certain members of different houses. So you can play as Call Me By Your Name, or you can play as Drax, or, oh, I'm sorry, actually, sorry, it says Paul Atreides here and the Beast. That is one of the funny things, that having not seen the movie, you can clearly recognize the actors that these cards are trying to portray. Sure. And yeah, it just sort of looks like you've chosen Drax or the guy from Call Me By Your Name. But yeah, each one of them is going to have a rule breaking power, or some of them are ongoing throughout the game, and some of them are one time uses. Paul Atreides has a very interesting power. You can always look at the top of your deck at any time. He knows the future. He has prescience. And then some of them, like the Beast, Glossu Raban, just starts the game with an extra spice and extra dollar, and that's it. But then everybody also has a signet ring power. There's one of your 10 cards in your starting deck has a little signet ring on it, and anytime you play that card, you get to do your signet ring power. Very simple, most of them. For example, Paul Atreides is just draw a card. Some of them are a little more interesting, like the Beast. I'll go back to that one. If you have alliance with a faction, you get to add one or two cubes to your garrison. So that's the most interesting thing to me about the game, is the whole combat element. So while you are trying to build your deck and cull your cards and do your basic deck building stuff, you are also every round thinking about a potential conflict. So there's a deck of 10 conflict cards, and every round you draw one off the top. They get the rewards of them become increasingly valuable towards the end of the game, because they're sort of level ones, level twos, and level threes. Sometimes you'll be fighting over a point. Again, we said the first to 10 wins, so those points can be quite valuable. The level 3 conflict cards often have 2 points on them, so that can be really important. But how that's decided is by who has the most cubes in the conflict. So cubes are another sort of resource that you're working with. Some action spaces give you cubes that go to your garrison, and some have a little crossed swords combat symbol that allow you to move cubes from your garrison into the conflict, which is sort of this space on the board where all our all the cubes mingle. And then at the end of the round, when everybody's passed, you add up all the points in the middle plus points you may have on cards. Each cube is worth 2. Some of your cards have 1 on them when you dump your whole hand, and you add them all up, and whoever got the most conflict points wins the number 1 reward. Second place gets the second, and if you're playing with 4 players, third place gets the third. And yeah, those are going to be goods or sometimes even points. And so that's a really interesting mix, because certain spots on the board allow you to add cubes to that. You could totally just ignore a conflict in the whole round, but then you're making it quite cheap for other people to get what are potentially very strong rewards. And yeah, I really like that element of it. What do you think about the way the whole conflict thing works?
I think it's very straightforward and simple. And I think it is really, what's the word I want to use? It's very in keeping with the game. Like, you know, it, like it's, it fits the tone of the game. Like, you know, yeah. So like
the game or Dune?
The game, like the game itself seems to be at a certain access point. And I feel like this, I don't want to say simple, but like, you know, this, it is, but like it's straightforwardness of how it all works out fits the game. And I feel like, you know, when you play your intrigue cards, do we talk about that yet?
Nope.
There are also some other cards you can get that give you instant bonuses or increased combat or end game points. And anyway, like, you know, you can play, when you play combat cards, like there's still that fog of war, but it's not so crazy that you can't anticipate it. So I think it feels, you know, within keeping of what the tone of the game is trying to achieve.
Yeah, there are some. So yeah, let's talk about the intrigue deck. The intrigue deck is probably my least favorite part of the game. So it's a deck of chaos, basically. A lot of there. So there are 4 factions in the game, and in order to go to a space attached to one of these factions, so there's 2 worker placement spots for each of the 4 factions. You have to play a card that has that faction symbol on it. And then when you go to one of those spaces, you improve your standing with that faction. When you've improved it twice, you get a victory point. When you've improved it 4 times, if you're the first person to do it 4 times, you get a temporary victory point that you could lose at when people get more influence with that faction than you. If somebody gets to the very top, they keep it forever. So that's a good way. There's 8 victory points just sitting on the board right there if you can get up all the way on all 4 factions, which you won't be able to do. So yeah, getting those factions and moving up on them is important. Well, I just lost my train of thought. What was I talking about in terms of the factions, Paul?
Intrigue.
Right. So yes, the Bene Gesserit is one of those 4 factions. Thank you very much. And the Bene Gesserit is all about getting intrigue cards. So there's a deck of chaos. Intrigue cards can either be plot cards, which are like one-time use things you can use in your turn. There can be end game points, which is just as, I think there's only a couple in the game, so they're not too egregious, but it's basically like, you have another point. So that's sort of the victory point cards in Catan element. It's like, oh, at the end of the game, ha, 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 look what I have in my hand. You thought you were winning, but I have some hidden points here. And then there are the combat cards, which I don't know if I like them. They're just, you just have to, I mean, it just sort of puts an element in the game of like, you never are sure if you're winning, which yes, that's a fine design development, but it's also like, It just causes too much to happen. And I don't know. It just makes it a little too chaotic, I think. And not necessarily in a fun, Dune-y way, but in just sort of a like, well, I know there's the card that gives you +4 combat. So I have to kind of, if I really am going to commit my whole turn to putting 6 cubes in the middle there, I might as well put 2 more in to make sure that I beat the card. Oh, you didn't have the card. So I wasted a whole turn doing that. Okay, great. That's fun. So, I mean, like, there's just enough swinginess in those that it, like, puts an element of, like, well, if I'm going to do something, I have to do something a lot in order to do it. And, I mean, I don't know. It's a level of chaos that's not necessarily very strategic to me, and nor tactical. It's just sort of chaos, and especially the ones that give you extra points. And I don't know.
It's almost like a dice roll.
A little bit. It is. It might as well just be a dice roll. Yeah, that's true. So there's that deck. And yeah, I mean, I really enjoy it. It's a bog standard deck builder, but it does it well. There's all the typical things you would imagine in a deck builder. So there's two strategies of, you know, are you going to go big money and race for these sort of victory point cards? So there's a card in the game that costs 9, which is a lot of money to be able to put together. And when you buy it, you get a victory point. But that card's pretty useless in your hand, sort of like the duchy cards or whatnot in
Dominion.
So you could just go a game where you're making sure you buy at least one or two of those every round. Two would be quite difficult, but it is possible because there are cards that lower the cost of it. Or you're going like pure conflict and you're really just racing towards winning the conflict and having a big thing. And then it just becomes sort of a race to see who can build their engines faster with that. And then a lot of it comes down to, as in most deck builders, who draws better and who gets luckier on getting those combo cards together at the same time. What else does the game do that's interesting? I mean, yeah, the worker placement stuff is fine. There are some, I do sort of like that some of the spots have the combat symbols on them. And anytime you go to combat symbol, you can add up to 2 of your cubes to the conflict. Those are interesting. I did find there are some good decisions in how I'm fighting over those places, but also the cards you're buying really decide where you're going to be going as well, because those cards limit where you can go. There are some early game decisions of, am I going to go for my third worker? So you have a third worker that you can buy one time in the game for 8 money. But if you have a third worker, then you have less cards when you dump your hand, which is going to give you less money to buy more cards. So you may think, well, worker placement game, I better race to that third worker. Family growth is the best thing I can do. Not necessarily in this game, because if you have that too early, you're never going to have very much money in your hand to buy more cards, because you're going to be playing 3 of your 5 cards every turn, which is a big difference between playing 3 of your 5 and 2 of your 5 in terms of money you're going to have to buy cards. And the cards are pretty expensive. So that's an interesting choice. There's also you can go to I forget what it's called, but you basically go to it once, it costs $5. And then for the rest of the game, you have an extra $2 to spend every time you dump your hand to buy cards.
The Landsrad High Council.
There you go. That also can be very powerful to go early on, but that's a lot of money, $5 early on. It's a little bit of a tempo swing there. And, there's some cool decisions to be made there. Spice is very valuable. There are a couple spots that in order to go to them, you have to spend spice. And spice is also the tiebreaker at the end of the game. I think this is a game that would often have 2 people hitting 10 at the same time. So spice can be, you know, really just banking spice and making sure you have more of it than the other person can guarantee your victory. There's some cool stuff going on. And it's, you know, it adds enough where to me it, and I'll just say it now, it completely replaces Lost Ruins of Arnak. I would have no reason to have both in my collection personally. As I think they both do the same thing. And I think this is a much more interesting version of it because of the combat, because of the asymmetrical powers, because of, the interesting things that it does with worker placements. I think it's also just a better design deck builder. So to me, of the 2 games this year that came out with the same sort of hybrid mechanics, to me, this is a definitely better. And also because I enjoy the theme more. I'm always going to enjoy Dune more. But Paul, tell me what you think in terms of this as a Dune game.
Well, you know, I will have to say that if you were to replace, if you were like, do you remember Rex? Is it called Rex? Like, you know, like, yeah. Basically. So there's Dune, the Avalon
Hill. Also called Rex Imperium, I think, or something like that.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, you know, so like there's the Dune Avalon Hill game. And then there was the reskin called Rex or Rex Imperium. I can't remember. Like, basically the same mechanics. And by stripping away the Dune IP, never played it. Like, you know, it was just like, meh. This is it completely takes away from the Avalon Hill.
So it's called Rex Final Days of an Empire.
Okay, sure. And ultimately, with this game, if you were to take the Dune IP away and put any other IP that could,
or just random space,
like elves, you know, like it's fantasy for Jake. You know, I would say that it plays exactly the same and it would have the same feel. So as a Dune game,
would you like it more or less?
I would. It would be neutral to me because, like, the Dune IP aspect does not really infuse into the game. It feels like there's an engine of a deck builder or whatever with a skin that is Dune, but like it could be anything. Like, you know, they're not connected to me.
Yeah, I agree with that. It doesn't necessarily, like, the board game, original board game of Dune really feels like Dune, and I don't even necessarily know why. It just really does. I think it's the insane level of asymmetry. When you think of Dune, you think of, you know, just wildly different alien factions. The whole thing is about, you know, trying to understand the ununderstandable sociologically between different cultures. And so it really gets that feeling of like we are all alien to each other and have completely different powers.
And to that point, like, you know, Dune is basically about intrigue. You know, Dune, Game of Thrones, it's about people dealing with other people in oftentimes nefarious ways, in, you know, in straightforward ways, whatever the case.
It's not as much about military power as about mental acuity.
Absolutely. And in the Avalon Hill game, though wildly asymmetrical and wildly unbalanced, it really captures that sense of intrigue in a way that this game doesn't even attempt to. You know, this game, so...
I mean, I guess the intrigue cards, like, oh, no, I have +4 combat this round. Ah, Dune.
But you're not really interacting with people, right? Whereas, like, within the Avalon Hill game, you need to... You are forced to... There are times when you are forced into an alliance. And you might not even want to be in an alliance with this person, but you need to, or you're going to die. And that tension, that, like, that choice is, like... integral in the Dune experience, whereas here you're always by yourself.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, there is no teaming together at all in any way. So there's an interesting thing, like, so the Bene Gesserit in the original Avalon Hill game, at the beginning of the game, they pick a faction that they think is going to win, and if that faction wins, they lose and the Bene Gesserit actually win. That's awesome.
Absolutely.
That's the best thing ever.
And those guys have the lowest win rate. But when they win, it feels so good.
Yeah. So and in this game, there's Baron Harkonnen has a power where at the beginning of the game, and it's clearly some sort of a nod to it, you choose two factions at secret, and there's special tokens here, and you choose them. And then at some point in the game, when you've put 4 troops in there, you reveal two of those factions and you you gain one influence with each of them. And it's just the level of how unexciting that is compared to the Bene Gesserit reveal at the end of the game. Like, that to me shows the difference between which one feels like Dune and which one is just a skin.
Yeah, no, I think, like, you know, as we move into the final thoughts, like, you know, I mean, I think in the end, like, this game is a very... For what it is, like, you know, for a deck builder plus a board, it's great. I mean, it really delivers what it promises in that term. In fact, so much so where I was playing it and I go, like, oh, I finally put my finger in it. I don't like deck builders. No. And you know, don't misunderstand me. I can appreciate it. It's like, I might not like goat cheese. I can appreciate good goat cheese, but, like, I it turns out that it is not my jam. Or my cheese. And I was playing this game and it really crystallized. Oh, I don't like deck builders because in the end, deck builders put a level of convolution between me, the game I like to play, between me and my opponents. Like, you know, there's this kind of, like, mechanical aspect that, you know, I'm it's not my jam. And that's totally fine. But, like, I don't resent this game for that. And in fact, I'm grateful for the game for helping me identify that aspect. Yeah. But, like, you know, so if you want a deck builder plus a board, I would wholly recommend this because, you know, it's an hour game for two player, maybe probably hour and a half, hour 45 for three.
Yeah.
And if you want, and if you want that experience, this will deliver. It will absolutely deliver, deck builder plus a little conflict. You know, nothing, I have no negative things to say about a game if you like this type of game. But like, you know, if you're looking for a Dune game, it falls for me 100% flat.
Yeah. You know? I mean, you know, it's, yeah, I mean, maybe once we've seen the movie, there'll be a little more like, oh, like an emotional connection to the images, sure, potentially. But yeah, now you said this game made you realize you don't necessarily like deck builders. I love deck builders. I've played them all. There's very few deck builders I haven't tried. I really enjoy deck building. I love Dominion. I think, but at this point I'm at a point where it's like, if I'm going to play a deck builder, I'd like to have it be different, sure, than your average deck builder, because feel like I've explored the design space of Dominion like deck builders, and there is nothing sort of new and exciting for me in discovery of that. And there is nothing new and exciting in Dune Imperium when it comes to deck building discovering. I really loved Taverns of Tiefenthal, mm-hmm, as a deck builder, because to me that felt like a very different deck builder, and that's sort of what I'm looking for in deck builders now, is something that's very different. This is just Dominion. It's just straight up the exact same sort of strategies plus a board, right? But in terms of the deck building, mm-hmm, right,
absolutely.
I enjoyed the novelty at first of like, oh, so I have to play a card, and that card decides what sort of worker placement spots I'm allowed to go to. That's fun. The order of I play them is fun. There are some cool new things there for sure. But the actual feeling of deck building and the decisions there, do I call my deck? Do I go for a draw deck? Those are basic Dominion level decisions. Am I going to have a slim mean deck that I'm drawing what I need every turn? Or am I going to decide to go for a deck that draws a lot, so I'm always getting a lot of cards and having a higher chance of getting what I want? Do I want to go big money in order to buy the high point cards that are going to help me win the game? Or do I want to go more balanced so that I can start putting combos together so I can buy the cheaper cards that are going to help me? I mean, it's just your basic Dominion decisions. And they're all here. So this is a game that I would recommend highly to people who deck building is something that is new and novel to them. I'd also recommend it to somebody who for worker placement is new and novel to them. This is a combination Taco Bell Pizza Hut. it's not the best tacos. It's not the best pizza, but you can get tacos and pizza here. and they're both good. And if you've never had great pizza or great tacos, you're probably gonna love it. You're probably gonna think it's great. And you're not wrong. It's solid. Yeah. And you can get them both there. But if you've traveled the world tasting every pizza, you're gonna be like, yeah, okay. I mean, this definitely is pizza
and tacos.
And tacos. I can't disagree with you. And you know what? I came hungry for pizza and tacos, and you gave me pizza and tacos, so I'm not mad at you, but not necessarily sure if this is my favorite pizza or tacos I've ever had.
No, I mean, it's very interesting because like when we first played it, like two player, like we both talked about how this is more fun than it deserves to be,
right?
And on
a turn to turn basis, we were both having fun with the decision space,
and I do wonder if it actually plays better with two. And don't misunderstand me. Like, yeah, you still have all the problems with, like, you know, if you're a seasoned deck builder or a seasoned worker placement person, blah, blah, blah. But like, but in the end, like, I think with that speed, it's not overstaying its welcome.
Like, combat becomes a little. Okay, you'll take this one, I'll take next one.
Exactly. And so
the difference between first and second in combat is so huge. It's like 1 point or two money. It's like, it's a huge difference. So it's like, if you're not going to win first, you don't bother. So I think in a two player, you do end up sort of just taking turns.
And you know, because I found like when we were playing three player, I was going like, oh, I never get that feel bad moment as Trey would describe it. But like, I do feel like, this is not doing what I wanted to do. I wonder if, like, you know, if you're like, say, a couple, and you are going like, oh, you know, I'd like to play a half hour game before bed, this, and just like just churn through this as far as a decompress, I could totally see that. I could totally see that. Like, I think there's value in this game. It's just not for our group. And I really, if you're a Dune fan, and if you're looking for a Dune game, this is not it.
Yeah, it's a skin. It doesn't feel like Dune to me. At least in terms of, like, you know, where we're all LARPing Dune. Like, there's no LARPing here, really. Sure. And having factions that are banding together and then betraying each other to me is what Dune is. And so there's games that do that better. It's a six. It's fine. I enjoyed it. I believe it will stay in my collection as a solid entry level worker placement deck builder with a fun theme. Whether or not it achieves that theme, I still like Dune. Just seeing Dune makes me happy.
I also say this could be a fairly good gateway game.
Yeah, absolutely. For people who aren't very familiar with, like, this is a great, like, I was actually thinking this is a great way to kill two birds with one stone with a new player. It's like, if you're new to the hobby and you play Dune Imperium, boom, you now understand two of the major mechanics of our hobby. You understand deck building, you understand worker placement. That opens up a whole world of games that you can play.
Yeah. And I think what its advantages, its bonuses are that it's actually very clear. It's not very convoluted. Yeah. So, like, you know, in either the deck building,
easy teach.
Exactly. Either the deck building or the worker placement. And if you're introducing someone to these concepts for the first time, I would actually say that this game would be great for that. You know,
yeah. I totally agree.
So if you're trying to, like, you know, convert your partner into playing a game, like, you know, they're not mm-hmm. a game player, and you go, here, we can play this, and in fact, it has combat too, so it has three things.
Yeah.
And I would say this is a gateway game. This is a 7-8 level gateway game.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of player count, I do agree. Two is solid with this one. It has a dummy player, but it's really very simple to use and enjoyable. It's just a deck of cards. You flip it over and you block a space every round, pretty much. Very simple to do, and does actually create tension and make it like, oh gosh, like, even if my opponent I know isn't going there, I don't know what the deck is going to do. I better take that spot now if I really need it. Yeah. So yeah, it very, very easy. You don't have to worry. This is not a coin level AI bot that you're going to have to spend 5 minutes going through a flow chart to figure out what they're going to do on their next turn. You just flip a card and block a spot. So yeah, really solid as a two-player game. It does play solo. I haven't played it. I read the rules. It's very similar. It's a slightly more complicated version of the two-player bot. But it wasn't interesting enough to me to try it as a solo. If I'm gonna play a solo, I like my solos to be pretty meaty and heavy.
Sure, sure. Make a meal of it.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, that's Dune Imperium. I think it deserves an audience. I think this is a game that will do quite well with a lot of people out there.
Yeah, I think in discussing this, I would recommend it slightly more than I initially thought, because I forget that people are entering the hobby. You know, sometimes I forget that.
Oh, like, yeah. No, we often. And yes, those are more. There are more of them than us. That's for sure. Sure. And when the Face Dancer expansion comes out, I will definitely give it a whirl.
Absolutely.
All right. Let's get into our guest segment this week. Member segment, as we call it. We are going to be giving you our top 10 meanest games ever made that are not war games.
our opinion, like, you know, like, there's
of course,
obvious, yes, right. Yeah,
we both racked our brains to think of what games we think of when we think of games that are mean. And of course, when we say mean, we don't mean a game that actually makes the other player really feel bad, but feel bad within the accepted space of our game group. We're not actually trying to hurt each other in a real way that exists outside of the game.
And yet.
And yet, we hope that these scars haunt them forever and that they see my laughing face in their dreams.
Well, you know, it's one of those things where, like, the memories that I have most of our game group are those where people have lost, you know, their minds for that night, you know.
Yeah. No, it's wonderful when somebody looks up and realizes what you've done and they say, you're evil.
Yeah. No. Like
you are true evil.
Like I used to say, and I still say, like, you know, the definition of a successful game night for Paul is when someone like absolutely fully invested loses their mind. And if that person is me, that is still a win. Like if someone's able to do that to me, I go like, well done. Well, I mean, like not in the moment, but like in, you know, like when I'm driving home at like 1 o'clock, I go like, that was a good game night.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. So I've ranked mine. You've ranked yours. Yeah, Shall we start with our tens? Well, number 10.
You know, I let me give some context real quick. Like, you know, and so like ultimately this list came from Dune Imperium, actually, because like I was thinking about how to the point Dune Imperium is to what it does, and then I thought about how like we should do a segment about that, where like, you know, like games that really just get to the meat of what it really is, and like sometimes what it really is not exactly what you think it's going to be. Like, you know, there's what the game is about, and there's what the game is about. And as I was making my list, I kept on going like, oh, actually, all the games I really care about, the about are the mean games. And so like, but like there are some games that like I feel like should have honorable mentions, like, you know, for me to be like K-List, which may show up on some other people's list, Innovation, Indonesia, Barrage, like, but more... Everyone says Diplomacy is the meanest game they've ever played. And I have never finished a game of Diplomacy, so I can't really say that. But, like, you know, if it's missing from our list.
I have never played a game of Diplomacy, which is probably crazy for people who know that I host a board game podcast.
Yeah. So I just wanted to make that note early on that, like, you know, there are a lot of mean games that don't make the list. Diplomacy is probably the one that is most notable. From our list, not to say, but, you know, truth be told,
this is a list of games we play that we think are mean.
Absolutely. But truth be told, I don't know who still plays Diplomacy.
That's sure there are people. Yeah, it's, well, I think Tom would say it's best to play by email.
Sure.
But yeah, there's probably, I mean, I'm sure if you go on BGG, you'll find a lot of people still playing it.
Maybe, but, like, you know, there's, you know, we tried Diplomacy 2020 for one round. and ultimately, like, in my research, I feel like there are, like, you know,
I can't say I haven't played Diplomacy because I did play one round of Diplomacy.
I feel like there are a lot of gambits and like blah blah blah, and I wonder if it's moved into like this kind of chess maneuver chess thing where now it's all just a matter of the nuance of things. So like it's not exactly what we in the hobby really enjoy anymore.
Right,
I don't know.
Right.
I don't know. But like, I know that at one time it was the thing to play. If you wanted to play any game, the adage is like, once you play Diplomacy, all games become Diplomacy, you know?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And that makes sense. Yeah. And in terms of games where you would look at somebody across the table and think that they're evil, I would, yeah, Diplomacy should be at the top of anyone's list, but it's not on either of ours.
No, it's not. So there you go. So yeah, top 10, let's go like one by one. Like, you know, our list is probably very different.
Yeah. What is your number 10 meanest game?
Well, my number 10 meanest game is not a very, it's a filler game, and it's a game brought to us by a listener of the podcast, David Gillison, and it's called Cockroach Poker.
Mm-hmm.
And it is basically a bluffing game, but and I won't need to go into the real intricacies of it, but like...
It's liar's dice, right?
Ish, but what makes it really great is that there is not one winner, there is only one loser. And what happens is the moment that there is just a little bit of blood in the water, everyone else gangs up on this person. And it is like, it is the friendly, smiley game version of Lord of the Flies.
And no, it is true. It is the person who loses is the first person to lose even a little bit. And
that's
then
right.
They're just done.
That's right. And so like, it is so fun to see, like, you know, with a smile, everyone at the table turning into the most base
carnal monster towards one picky character.
Yeah.
So that's really good. Yeah. So Cockroach Poker. Well done, David Gilson.
Well done. My number 10 is Fort. Now, when I was thinking of this list, I was thinking not only of games that I think are the meanest, which you'll see more towards the top half, but also games that I think do mean things in really interesting ways that I hadn't seen before. And Fort is actually a good example of a deck builder that I really enjoy because it's very different. And this one aspect of it I just love, which is that all cards that you don't play that turn are placed above your board and can be taken by any other player at the end of their turn. And to me, there's something so fun of when you have to build up your little combo deck and you can't play both pieces of your combo this turn, and somebody just breaks your combo and takes that character just because they know that you need that combo. And where you find yourself in a position where you have no choice but to lose your most important card, and it's delicious.
And I will say there, like, you know, with Fort, there's an aspect where you're complicit in your own demise.
Yeah, no, it's you built this combo, and it came about in a way where you legally can't play your combo this turn, and so you have to break your combo and put one of them in front, and that turn you're just looking at your phone, pretending that you don't care, pretending that your most important card in the whole game isn't just sitting there, hoping nobody notices, and then it comes to Paul's turn, and they go, Matt, I know you don't want me to take that card. I know you're sweating and shaking inside right now, hoping that I haven't noticed that you put your most important card out there. And I just want you to know that I know that. And and that's a very good, fun, mean moment.
Yes, absolutely. 100%.
What's your number 9?
Number 9 is Dune, because how could it not be? Dune, Avalon Hill. As Tom would say, there is a treachery card deck. There are, you know, the Harkonnens are remarkably mean. And
it's actually, it's Dune Gale Force 9 now. They're the ones who own the own the brand now.
Oh, okay, yeah. And like ultimately, what I really enjoy about that is like there are moments when everyone needs to like make an alliance. And ultimately you are forced into alliance with people who you maybe have been playing against the whole turn, the whole game, actually. And like there's a certain cruelty about that. And the only reason why you are stuck with these people is because like if you don't, then the other alliance is going to wipe both of you out. And so it's this huge and these people, you know, may not be your friends in the next turn. So there's always this tension, this paranoia about working with people, and I think it really captures the meanness of all real intrigue, you know, like the cruelty of that. So I thought it deserved to be.
I would have thought if you had asked me what I thought Paul's top 10 would be, I would have put this in the top 2 or 3.
Yeah, no, it's
surprised it's at 9.
It is because like I don't know if I thought enough about the list.
My number 9 meanest game is much like Fort, a game that I think does meanness in a new and interesting way. This is Architects of the West Kingdom. I like bog standard mechanics with cool twists on them. And Architects of the West Kingdom does a cool twist on worker placement, wherein at the beginning of the game, you have a giant pile of workers and you think it's never ending and you're never going to run out of workers. And you just throw them around like dollar bills. And then people start imprisoning your workers and capturing them. And you realize if you go to a place too many times, it becomes quite a juicy place for somebody to come and literally imprison your workers and then sell them to the jail for money. And then you have to go and free your workers and waste actions. And that can feel very mean and in a fun and interesting way.
Oh, yeah. And it's within the other people's favor to do. At some point, you go like, oh, I need to really take all your meeples away and profit from them.
Well, and it becomes a cool thing like Agricola, where it's like there's 6 wood sitting there. I don't really need 6 wood right now, but I better take 6 wood. It's the same thing with your workers become that 6 wood at some point. It's like, well, Matt's gone there 5 times. If he goes there again, he's going to get so much stuff. I'm just going to take all his workers and get $1 each for them.
So super fun. Number 8 for me is Bus. Now, Bus is a splatter game, and
a lot of splatter on this list.
And for me, like, I've condensed them. Like, you know, ultimately, like, you know, Indonesia, you know, forcing a merger, the worst, you know, or having to ship, and like, even though you don't want to, because it's going to cost you money to ship, like, you know, that all it's, you know, and you have like Greed Inc. and you have all, you know, all these other,
Splatter could just be called mean games.
There's always a mean aspect about Splatter. The reason why I pick Bus is because it gets to it quicker.
Yeah.
Basically, you're making some bus routes. You're trying to get people home or to the bar or to work, and the only problem is like the person next to you,
right?
And it's you know, at round one you're going like, oh, this is going to be fine, and by round two, knife. So Bus is my pick for my top splatter game.
That's pretty great. My number eight is Terraforming Mars, a game that isn't mean except for the one or two cards that are mean, and they are feel bad cards. It's just asteroid, boom. Who has four plants? You have four plants, Trey? Yeah, you don't have those four plants anymore. Why did you do that to me? Here's my favorite thing about Terraforming Mars, though. It's totally optional. When anytime you play a card that has take that on it, the rules tell you that you could just choose not to, which to me is so mean, because that means, of course, you always should do it. It's always the correct thing. Like, if you're playing to win, you want someone to have less of something, of course. But the fact that they leave it up to you to do just feels mean, because the other player goes, you don't have to do that. You don't, like, it doesn't benefit you at all for me to lose my four plants. And then you go, oh, I know. Yeah, yeah. You lost four plants, buddy. Move on. It's just mean. It makes you feel mean. And I think it's funny that they decided that it was optional, because if you don't do it, why didn't you do it? What are you doing?
No, Ben was telling me about your game with him and Trey and Tom, and ultimately he could not get.
They started an asteroid war.
Exactly. It just rippled throughout our Maria game, as far as like, you know, like him bitching about Trey.
Well, and in fact, that is the reason that it's optional, right? Is because you can go to that person. I'm not doing this to you so that you will not do it to me later. We have an agreement. And then the person goes, oh yeah, we have an agreement. And they just do it to you because they were trying to win.
Yep. No, it's farming in space and asteroids.
Yeah.
Number seven for me is an oldie. And I've mentioned this game before in like games that create memories. It's Kremlin. And basically, suffice to say, it's a very farcical. And I think the hallmark of at least most mean games, successful ones or ones that are that I would put on my list, have a bit of whimsy, or you can laugh at the cruelty. You know, like there are probably games that are just no mean without laughing, and I think that doesn't make a very good mean game. Kremlin is one where you are basically trying to support the right guy at the right time in the Kremlin. And rather than go into all of it, like, you know, it's just very backstabby. It's very you're causing cruelty to one another, but it's so funny. It's so funny. And like, you know, and not to say that cruelty and humor should be always linked, but I do think so. They should be in games. And this does it better than most, I think.
I just realized we played a good mean game recently that didn't make my list, but The King is Dead. That's a good mean game.
Yeah. That worked out.
Total mean game.
Worthy and honorable mention.
Absolutely. My number seven is Agricola. You may not think that German farming in the 16th century is mean, but you would be wrong. Agricola is very mean because everybody wants to do the same things. Everybody wants to expand their house. Everybody wants to have more workers. Everybody wants to get their occupations on the board, and not everybody can do it. And so the game is all about doing the thing that benefits you the most while at the same time hurting your opponent the most. And every decision you make in Agricola has to be based on what is best for me. That is also the thing that's going to make everyone else groan the most. And that makes Agricola a very cutthroat and mean game.
Groaners. Yeah, that's also a good quality of a mean game. Like, you know, like if you can cause your opponent or people to go, oh.
Yeah. Well, if somebody's like, I need 6 wood this turn in order to expand my house. And then somebody who's already expanded their house, who doesn't need to expand this turn, takes the wood and you just go, oh, cool. I lost. Great. That's the end of my game. I hate you. Like, that happens a lot in Agricola. Great. Yeah. Okay. Thanks for doing that. Yeah. No, that's my whole game.
And as the future world Agricola champion, you would know.
Yeah. I would know. I would know what it feels like mainly to do that to other people and never have it done to me.
Sure. Sure.
Number six.
This is a game that I would not have picked until we started playing it, like about Thanksgiving 2019. And that's okay. Through the Ages.
Yes.
And
the Ages can be mean.
And so, like, Matt and I, like, I was in Terre Haute, Indiana, helping my mother-in-law with her hip surgery. And so we were, I was like, distance gaming, which, you know, where everyone else was playing games live. And so Matt, you know, took pity on me. He was like, well, you should get Through the Ages, not to make you sound like, you know, dumb, but like, you should get Through the Ages, we can play blah blah blah. And
accurate impression.
And we kind of had our own little back and forth meta, and it was fine. And then we invited Alfred and Trey, and then it became
very mean.
Oh my god. Like, you know, and because when you're playing,
there's a real cockroach poker aspect to
absolutely that game. Absolutely. Yeah. It was so
the first person who's militarily weak is just going to get pillaged turn after turn after turn. War and just drive you into the ground, and everyone is going to eat you alive.
What was interesting was, like, in a two-player game, I didn't notice, because, like, ultimately, oh, I'm vulnerable, Matt attacks me, he gets his stuff, and then I bolster up. But, like, in a three-player game, oh, if I get behind the curve, you know, Matt attacks me. Oh, well, then Alfred goes like, oh, well, since you're weak, I'm going to attack you too. And then Trey goes, okay.
Then we're all jockeying, like, who's going to get to feast off of Alfred this turn? Like, no, I wanted to feast off of Alfred. Like, get back. It's my turn. It's my turn to steal all of his points.
And like, you know, and you would say that, you know, I mean, there are definitely feel bad moments, but, like, you know, in a way, it's kind of self-inflicted, because you got behind, you know, like, you know, we are
you had the hubris to think you didn't need to improve your military every turn because, you know, you were going to run away with a culture victory. Like, good
absolutely
luck.
And so I've never had it where, like, you know, where we played a lot, you know, between let's see, November to, I think we played as deep into as, like, April. Like, we probably played
50 games of it or something.
Yeah, it was one of those things where, like, you know, we're playing and I'd get a text from Trey, like, it's your turn.
Yeah.
Just, you know, it's your turn. And it was, but no matter how vicious, like, you know, a feasting was, let's call it that, like, no one ever was, like, going, like, oh, I don't want to play this game. It was always, like, yeah. It was, like, I got
brutal again?
Exactly. I got brutalized. Let's do it again. And
you should fire that one up again.
Yeah, and the app is amazing. Like, you know, like,
it is what all apps are compared to for me.
In terms of
how multiplayer asynchronous works.
Absolutely. And I'm sure it works fine with BGA. BGA tends to have a pretty gold standard for automation, but, like, the app, just pay for the app.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Well, because you can have it on your phone and it works really well.
Absolutely. So Through the Ages, that's one. It's an investment, though. The game requires some study.
My number six is the first modern board game I ever played. It is Battlestar Galactica, and for one reason only, the airlock. That's it. Just being able to blast somebody out of the airlock.
Which is in the, what you call it, which is in the expansion, in the Pegasus expansion.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
No, like,
but yeah, Battlestar Galactica can be a mean game of on purpose lying to your friends the entire time. And I think you will probably have a more refined crack-like version of this later on in your list.
Sure, sure. Like, I remember Battlestar Galactica. This was where I saw the ranges of Tom's character in two instances. One, he was a Cylon. I was a Cylon, and we made this move. I go like, oh no, he's going to rat me out, and he doesn't. I go like, oh, I know something about you. You know something about me. We're gonna destroy. And you know, and that's you know, Tom's cleverness and blah blah blah. But you know, when I think of games where Tom like nearly crossed the line, it's this one game of Battlestar Galactica where Dimitri had to choose between me and Tom as the bad guy, and Dimitri chose Tom as the bad guy, which was, he was wrong. I was a Cylon, and Tom red faced yelled at Dimitri like where, and it was so, you know, like when talking about losing your mind, this was a key example of that. And we talk about it afterwards. They go like, oh, I think Tom pushed it to the limit, like any further than like, you know, it would be bad sportsmanship. But like, it was so good. It was like, it was the Olympic moment of my, you know, of my desire to have like someone lose their mind. Like you couldn't get better than this. This was the 3-star Michelin.
right.
So yeah, Battlestar Galactica. Woo, love it.
All right, we move into the top five.
Top five.
What is your five?
My number five is a game that doesn't get as much love as I would like. It's called Santiago. And ultimately, it's a game about, you know what? This is maybe the only farming game that I like. Because you're making potatoes, you're making stuff. But like,
no, you like Bonanza. You like Bonanza.
Sure. But in this particular game, the twist is that one person is gonna you should only play with five, and one person is going to be what's called the canal overseer. And so this person has the choice of either feeding your crops or letting them turn into dust. And ultimately, these people who you were once your friends, once fellow farmers, are now trying to convince you to go their route, so their you know, crops don't die. In other words, once you're friends, now you are extorting them for water. and each round this can change who becomes the canal overseer. But like, ultimately, like what it really does, it forces people to really just play into that mafioso type, like, you know, hey, yeah, you know, you're going to give me this or you're. So I really like that aspect of that.
I'm dying to play this game. Tom gifted me a copy of it and I have yet to play it.
Oh, it's excellent.
My number five, speaking of famous stories of near implosions at our board game table, is Eclipse. Eclipse, or more recently, the Eclipse New Dawn, is a Space 4X game that can get pretty mean. That can definitely have people ganging up on each other as you fight for the center of the board, and famously is probably the biggest near friendship ending fight that we've ever had at a board game between Tom and Dimitri. Tom seems to be the reoccurring character a lot of these near friendship ending fights.
Well, for all of it, let's be clear. Tom is actually very calm for most times.
He like, really is. Yeah.
Like, you know, I think
but he gets ganged up on a lot in these games.
Absolutely. Like, I don't want to be,
because he's good at them.
Absolutely. And ultimately, like, he is not accustomed, as you know, as a game master, you know, he's not accustomed to being like thrown under the bus. You know, and so when people tend to do that or not believe him, you know, in absolute terms, like, you know, I feel that he's vulnerable. And the moment that we're referring to is, here is Matt, you know, having a fundraiser for
fundraiser.
And this is like, you know, this is the game that we're playing. And Tom is losing his cookies because Dimitri goes like, oh, I think that that you're more of a danger than Paul is. And to be completely honest, Dimitri was right. He won the game. He analyzed the situation correctly. And because Tom either didn't see that or was just so blinded by the fact that Dimitri was going to, like, you know, damage his position, you know, he got a little red-faced. And you know, another one, another moment in the Chronicles of this also, I also lost my cookies on this game too. There was one time where Tom and I allied, and then Tom just like, Tom is not a person who enjoys betraying, but if it's too good,
yeah,
you know, he will. And he just like, we teamed up, and then he just slaughtered. He was like a weed whacker, and I was playing Planta, so I was the Planta. He was just cutting me to pieces. And there was, you know, and I was upset. And there was a moment where I coined the phrase, well, that wasn't how I was taught. and so in our game group, there's occasions where, like, you know, when someone is losing, and that is the mantra, well, that's not how I was taught.
And right. You claim that ignorance.
Yeah. And it was, in my case, true. But like, I remember that with fondness and smiles. Like, 'cause I'm driving back home, I go, like, oh, that was cathartic on my part. Like, it got all that energy out. I'm so angry.
It's amazing.
Beautiful.
What is your number four?
My number four is a game called Fresh Fish. And we talk about this game a lot. Once again, very under BG.
Also a game I have never played.
Really? Well, yeah. We talk about it as being a, what's the word? Kind of a, like, negative space game. But like in that negative space aspect, like, you know, there is of all these games, this one is probably the most like an abstract. What it is like, you're keeping all this stuff in your head because it's all theoretical until things have to be laid. And so now you're placing your cubes. And what we find that happens is I'm blocking you, theoretically. And there comes this point where it's like watching Magnus Carlsen and Hikaru Nakamura, like one and two chess players in the world, like, you know, talk about the present chess game. And like, you know, 10 moves down there, you know, there's going to be a draw. And then one of them goes like, oh, I didn't see that move. And so like in this game here, like, you know, like you get blocked in ways that someone does it and is so mean, and it's not even on the board yet, you know. It's all just like, it's like, oh, you destroyed me, five moves from now I'm dead. And it's not it's just so good. It's just so good in the how you can be completely destroyed without ever seeing it on the board yet.
Yeah, a lot of these mean games I haven't played with you guys. Maybe you guys don't want me involved in them or something.
Well, you know, you are fragile.
You know something about me I don't want to know. My number four is one of the ones you mentioned as sort of the prototype of when you think about mean games. But for me, my number four is Kalis, or Kalis 1303, yep. The new version of it. The Bailiff is a quintessential board game Euro mean. You get to move the Kalis. I mean, you get to move the bailiff, back and forth on the worker placement track, and you can totally destroy somebody by deciding that the action that they wanted to take is no longer happening, because only actions before the bailiff will happen this turn.
And what's great about this game is like that is like it's one of the best parts of the meanness, but the whole game is like pretty mean, you know, and in this particular case here, this is where, when I think of Dimitri melting down, you know, this is where Trey and Dimitri had an agreement. Trey violated that agreement in Dimitri's eyes, and we had to stop play.
Wow.
Like, Dimitri was going like, I gotta leave.
That's amazing.
Yeah, you know, and later on, like, you know, there was discussion of blood sugar, blah blah blah, but in the end, like, you know, it was so I count it as a win.
Yeah. Kalos is one of those games that people often give you the caveat of make sure you're playing this with people that you're all very comfortable with each other, because it can have a lot of feel bad moments.
Absolutely.
Number three.
This is one of my favorites. All these top three, it turns out to be some of my favorites, as you would expect. And it is The Estates. Mm. You know, The Estates, you know, it's basically build some stuff. But what really makes it great is, like, it's better to hurt people than to help yourself. And it's, you know, it's a bidding game. It has other aspects to it. Like,
A classic auction game.
Yeah, we talk about it in one of our episodes, so I won't bore you with that. But, like, what it really does well is it makes you focus on hurting other people. And I know that sounds awful. First of all, I'm a lovely person, you know.
Mm-hmm. you're not, but it's good to say that.
Exactly. But in the end, like, you have to admire a game that really knows what it wants to be. And, like, right. And, like, I think the veneer of The Estates is like, oh, here, you're just a real estate developer, blah, blah, blah. But there's one rule that basically says, like, you know, and if you don't complete blah, 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 these go negative. And it turns out that one rule is the crux of the game.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, only two of these three rows are going to score, and one is going to be a negative score.
And so with that pivot, like, you know, you wind up the game is completely different than what it purports to be because of that one rule, and it's so cutthroat. Yeah. Anyway. Yep.
You may see that on somebody else's list coming up. Ooh. My number three is Food Chain Magnet. To me, yes, all splatters belong on this list. But for me, the meanest of them is Food Chain Magnet, because a good part of mean game ruling is it's your fault if this happens to you. And Food Chain Magnet, it is your fault if you allow somebody to do this horrible thing to you, which is steal all of your clients. And by blanketing the town in flyers that you've flown down from your airplane advertisement campaign, and you've ruined everyone's life, and I hate you forever for doing it. There are a few games that make me feel more upset at myself than Food Chain Magnet, because it's always your fault when you
lost customers.
Throw out all your food, and you lost all your customers.
Yeah, throwing out your food is what's tough. That's for me. That's really tough.
Yep, that is Food Chain Magnet number three. We're in the top two. Your number two, Paul?
I think, like, here's where people who have known me on this podcast would guess, like, this would be number one, but it's not. And that is The Resistance to Avalon. Ooh. And we've talked a lot about this game on the podcast, so I'm not going to really.
Some would say too much.
Many. Many will say too much, but, like, ultimately, any game that forces you to lie to some of your best friends without remorse is got to be up there. And, like, and when we talk about games that mean games that don't hurt friendships, I feel like this is a game that came the closest between you and me, like that time where, like, you know, like, basically. I was a bad guy. I told Matt that I was Merlin, like, you know, and Tom had to choose between me and Tom. And Tom was going, Paul's the bad guy. And I go, no, Matt, I'm Merlin. And he had to choose, and he chose me. And after, like, the good guys lost, Matt, like, leans back and says, I think you've hurt our friendship. I don't think, like, as a person, Paul, I don't think I can trust you.
Yeah. It was rough. Not as rough as the time where I winked at
you. Oh, yes. That
you know that I was Merlin. And then you quickly said to the table, guys, Matt just winked at me. I think he's a spy. And I was like, what would you do?
This was a con, too. That was so funny. Yeah. So we're playing it with a bunch of strangers. Matt makes a move, like, you know, to try to save us. And I go, like, I think he's trying to trick me.
It's called overthinking.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah. Number two for you, buddy.
My number two is 1830, or really any 18XX, but it's hard to get meaner than 1830. In any game where you can dump a company on another player and have it sink them to the bottom of the ocean like a 1,000-pound anchor, that is a mean game. And that is exactly what 18XX can do, specifically the original mean 18XX game, 1830. Yeah, it's often the right thing to do is to bankrupt a company and then force it onto another shareholder by getting in the right position in turn order where you can sell your stocks and then thus make somebody with a minor sharehold now become the major shareholder and the president. And now they have a company with no trains, and they have to buy trains, and they have to spend their own money, and then the game literally ends because they went bankrupt, and that's the end of the game.
Well, you know, on a side note, like this, you know, this reminds me of another game on the brain that I forgot to mention. It's called Wall Street versus Reddit Investors.
Yeah. It's a crazy game. It's a chaos bomb.
It is quite like, you know, this idea that, like, you know, I mean, however you feel about it, like, you have to admire the tactic unlock that the Reddit investors chose to do. Like, you know, as far as like, let's pump up this stock, and everyone who is shorted, you know, could be in theory, like, you know, liable for infinite amount of money. I mean, that's a mean game.
We've come to the final meanest game of all time, Paul. What is your number one meanest game?
And this is, I don't know if it's going to be a surprise, but like, it is Age of Steam.
Wow.
I don't think it's a surprise that, like, you know, that train games are up there. Train games in general are mean. I picked Age of Steam, because not only, and Tom and I have the same viewpoint on this, and I think most people would have. It's like, not only are you encouraged to really be mean to the other players, but the game itself is mean to you all. It is just, you know, with the always having to pay for your stocks and, like, you know, progressive taxes, like, it creates an environment where.
Yeah, Martin Wallace is being mean in this game.
Absolutely. And you're asking for it. And you come to play, and you're asking for it. And the reason why you're playing it is because if you can just get over that plateau, if you can just make $0 that you're winning, and you're like, oh, I've accomplished something.
Yeah, your whole game is just trying to get out of debt.
For the longest time, I could not deal with it. I could not deal with staying in debt for 2/3 of the game. That was just an impossibility for me. Yeah. Because of, you know, if it's not just a feel bad moment. It's a feel bad experience. But like, once I was able to compartmentalize that, I go like, oh, there's a certain genius in this game on how every decision, like, you know, oh, you take locomotive. Well, I'm going to take first move, and now, like, you know, so there's counter move, and it plays so differently with each map or player count. You know, it has, I wouldn't say infinite, but it has a great variety of the different type of meanness that can happen. Whereas, like, you know, all the other games that I have described today, they all have a very specific meanness that they lean into. Whereas Age of Steam, there are a lot of different ways to be not nice to the people that you love, that your friends. And I haven't seen anyone really, at least in our group, there's a lot of laughter about it. When it happens, you're like, oh, groans. That's it. There are so many groan moments in Age of Steam. It's beautiful.
It is a groan simulator. My number one is your number three. It is The Estates. To me, this is just a game designed to only let you simulate emotional violence against your friends. Yeah, I mean, just the fact that it's all about feel like 18XX in the sense that you are trying to dump the worst company on somebody else. And each potential row where you're building things is a company in the game. And only two of those companies are going to score, and one of them is going to sink people. And you're trying to make sure that, you know, in this awful game of musical chairs, you're not the one stuck on the dead row. That's negative points. while meanwhile trying to make sure that everyone else is stuck there. It is truly mean and delicious. And and I think all mean, truly games that are as mean as this should only last 45 minutes.
Sure.
And that's what the Estates does.
Well, and you know, something about the Estates that, like, we didn't mention, it's like a losing score could be negative 15 and a winning score could literally be the least negative or like one.
Oh yeah. No, we've had games before where it's whoever had the least negative score. Absolutely.
So come on. No, it's beautiful. You got to appreciate for its beauty.
Absolutely. That was fantastic, Paul. That was our top 10 meanest games of all time. You have time for a couple of smalls?
Let's do it.
Sometimes a player just got to know which game should stay, which game should go.
I tried to leave it, but you know, there's an episode about meanness, so I have to cut it short. I mean, if I'm gonna play the whole theme, it's not gonna be on the mean episode.
That's right. Exactly.
All right.
Exactly.
I really hope I haven't read this one before. I don't think I have, but sometimes I wonder, oh man, did I already read this one? I hope not. This is from Cindy Lum. Hello, Game Brainers. Really enjoy the pod. My husband and I have been playing games together since 2005. We've played a wide breadth of games, but not any one game more than 5 to 8 plays usually. We've failed the 10x10 challenge several years in a row. Same. We've stopped trying. Too many new and shiny games. I've recently been pushing for us to play a new game 2 to 3 times before we put it away to get more plays in and to make a more educated decision on how we feel about a game. Sometimes I just want to pull out a game that I know how to play without having to read the rule book again to refresh. Listening to rules explanations can turn me into a zombie, but it is hard with these longer games. Husband loves Clans of Caledonia. We just tried Gaia Project and he said it was a lot of fun, so I'm hoping we can get it to the table again soon. We've also recently played Maracaibo, Rococo, Outlive, Lorenzo, Great Western Trail, Dice Hospital, Riverboat, Heaven and Ale, and Brass Birmingham. Do you have any suggestions for similarly weighted games that plays well with two that we could possibly make a lifestyle game that we could play more often? Co-ops need not apply.
I love that last part. That part is great.
That's going to be on my gravestone, I think.
Well, you know, I Lorenzo and Great Western Trail were my first thoughts, and I feel like those tend to be very lifestyle games, like games that ultimately get to the point real quick. I think winds up being like, you know, without a lot of convoluted things to achieve what it's trying to do. And so the game that I came up with that I think would fit this is a game that we used to play a lot, you know, and the game is called Hawaii.
Yeah, Hawaii is fun. Hawaii is a really solid medium weight game.
Yeah, and it's within the Lorenzo Great Western Trail, what you call it, weight. It plays pretty quick. The rules are very simple. And if I remember correctly, like, you know, it gets to what it is real quick. So, like, if you like the game, like, you can pull it up, play it, put it away, go sleep. I mean, I think it plays fairly quick at two. And I remember, like, I think games that are lifestyle games tend to have a certain lightness to it, you know. And the artwork, for example, in Hawaii, it's very, like, you know, these calming blues and, like, the sand, and it feels just aesthetically, it's soothing, you know. I mean, I suppose Wingspan would work too. Wingspan is, you know, is around that weight, and you know, and you know.
Yeah, okay. They're naming some kind of heavy games here, Paul. I mean, she said Gaia Project, etc. I'm going to go the other way here, and they want a lifestyle game, so they want a game to me that has infinite replayability, where they can really explore the strategies. And I think you're looking for Agricola. I think the ultimate two-player lifestyle game is Agricola. I think if you get the revised edition, you maybe get one or two of the expansion boxes with, you know, just the decks. You have an infinite number of cards. Drafting is fun with two. Some people say Agricola with two is, you know, a little tic-tac-toe-y. But I still think there's a ton to explore there. I would also say Newsford, if we're going to stick with Uva, because it's a little faster. But then also, of course, Fields of Arl, if you're looking for a really deep two-player game. I think Uva is your guy. But yeah, I think also On Mars or even Terraforming Mars are both great two-player heavy lifestyle games that you could probably play you know, once or twice a week for a couple of years.
So I guess it really comes down to what the question is asking. Is the question asking, like, what can I play with my partner, my husband, that, like, you know, can, that's just the experience replayability, or is it a matter of, like, diving into the deepness of the strategy? I don't
know. To me, it sounds like the deepness, but we've given them now answers for both. So hopefully something.
So Cindy, good luck.
Good luck.
Oh, and let me know which one's right. Just let us know on the Facebook. Say, oh.
Yeah, when it's Matt, just make sure that we know that. Next up is from Mean Episode. Next up is from Samar Sika. My nephew loves board games, but has a really hard time getting the rest of the family to the table. I've introduced them to party games like Concept, Wavelength, and Telestrations, but those are too light for my nephew's tastes. He turns 12 at the beginning of April, and I'd like to get him a solo game for his birthday. Can you recommend some solo games that are high in strategy, have high replay value, and are available to purchase now? His favorite game to play is Pandemic, but even the hardest difficulty is pretty easy for him. Thanks so much for your response and all the work you do in putting together a great podcast every week. It's hard to believe that we are just a few months shy of the podcast 2-year anniversary. Thank you, Samar. I will recommend two of my very favorite solo games, which is one would be Nemo's War, which I think is a very good thing if you like Pandemic but want something that's a lot harder. Nemo's War is great. And my other, if you want just a really fun solo adventure with endless replayability, you can't go wrong with Too Many Bones, although your wallet will hate you.
It's interesting because, like, I, you know, it's a little hard for me to know what to. First of all, I'm not the solo guy, so, you know, just know that. I wonder, does High Frontier have a solo mode?
Yes, I believe it does.
And
that's pretty intense for a 12. That's pretty intense for a 42-year-old.
Sure. I am just saying, like, you know, but in the end, This is the one time that Tom will go like, oh my God, did Paul mention High Frontier? Not in the negative. and ultimately, like, with that, like, that is, like, I believe you can learn, like Tom taught Aiden fairly young. And ultimately, like, it's worth study. It's, you know, and you're always going to be improving. And I feel like that is, that's probably what, you know, like, I would suggest, like, you know, it's something, it's very heavy, but it's not inaccessible heavy. It's just, there's a lot. And so the idea of, like, building, you know, you're, you know, going into the solar system step by step, no other thing does it quite like that. And I feel like its intricacies are going to be favorable to someone of that age, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, I could see that. I have not played it, so I don't know.
But you have a beautiful map of it, right?
I do. Sitting here gathering dust. Let me do one last one, just because I love how to the point this one is. This is from Eric Brimmer. Hi, great job, guys. Love your show. Looking for games with the following characteristics: 1, soloable; 2, complex and interesting strategy, but not one where you constantly have to go back to the rule book once learned; 3, easy setup; 4, nice components. Boom, bam, boom. That's the whole email. That's the tweet. Send. I have 3 answers for you. First one is Noosphere. When you say soloable, I assume you also mean not just solo. And Noosphere is fantastic solo, but also incredible all the way up to a player count of 5. It is very complex and interesting strategy, but it genuinely, you will never have to go back to the rule book again. Sets up in minutes. I'm talking minutes. And has beautiful components if you like Uwe Rosenberg style components. My next one breaks Rule 3, but I still think it's worth looking into, which would be Anachrony. And very soloable, very complex and interesting strategy. I don't think you're going to have to go back to the rule book. Beautiful components, maybe not the fastest setup in the world, but there are worse. Paul, any thoughts for this person's concise question?
No, I'm not a person who knows his components, and I'm not soloable. So, like, I don't think I can give you a really educated answer.
Yeah. Well, check out Newsford. I think Newsford set, is definitely going to be, or Glass Road would also be another good one.
I mean, Gloomhaven, right? I mean, I assume that if it's all over.
Yeah. Easy setup though. Yeah. Definitely. That's the hardest setup, mm-hmm. the worst possible setup. Although Jaws the Lion does help with it a bit. Well, Paul,
we did it.
I would say it was lovely hanging out with you today, but this is the meanest episode.
Hey,
so,
hey, all I know is, like, you know, I have a lot of friends, and I just wish you were one of them.
Yeah. if we were doing the top 11 favorite members of this podcast, I just want you to know you'd be on it.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
You'd be on the list.
I can't guarantee that you would.
All right, Paul. Yep. I love you. Always a pleasure.
You too, brother.
Yeah, we'll see you next week. You've been listening to Game Brain, produced and edited by Matthew Robinson and Tom Donnelly. Special thanks to Daedalus for our incredible music. You might know them as Alfred on the show. More on Daedalus at gamebrainpod.com. You can reach us by email at contact@gamebrainpod.com or on Twitter at gamebrain_pod. Instagram is @gamebrainpod. Thanks for listening, and go play some games with friends online or virtually make some friends with games. Ta-ta.